by a mile. True and true. So therefore, it's a bunch of rich guys at country clubs calling their wealth manager saying, put me into crypto. The adoption is going straight up. Absolutely false. Absolutely false. I was talking to a friend today and he pointed out, he goes, what you have to understand about rich people is they're already rich. So when people talk about in crypto, if you don't own crypto, have fun staying poor. They're not poor. They're already rich. And what do rich people want to do? Not be poor. That's why they like conservative investments, because it doesn't make, they already have a Porsche and a lake house and they already fly first class. They don't need a risky investment to become that. They already are that at this point. So what I think you're seeing in crypto is you're seeing a lot of small retail traders, a lot of hedge funds, a lot of HFTs. And my fear has been, yes, this money has been pouring in greater than everybody thinks, but I think it's very, very weak-handed money. Mm. And I think it could leave just as fast as it came. And today was an inkling of that. And I think you could see more of that. So we'll see where we go from here.
One of the thoughts that you've been sharing is your concern about the money that flows into the ETFs, what that ultimately means for investment in the space, or the opportunity cost of the money that's being invested in the ETF versus going directly into the coins or into the ecosystem themselves. I wonder if you could expand on that for the audience here.
I'm a bull in the space, and I've been a big fan of the space for one simple reason. I think it's an alternative financial system. And I think that what you're seeing between all of the chains and all of the protocols is the budding of that, something else. I think that the most of the world, and I'm talking about Latin America, Asia, Africa, the Middle East, they have shaky currencies and they have corrupt financial systems and they need an alternative. We, and I'll talk specifically, JP Morgan's had 150 years to bring our system to them and they haven't. So it's never going to come to them. So they need this new system. We need to have this whole ecosystem be built out. It's not there yet, but it can be there. My fear with this crypto, with these ETFs, is if you're just going to reduce this down to the maximalist argument that it's just sound money and that's all we need, is we just need something with a 21 million coin hard cap done, the perfect instrument ever, nothing more needs to be done. You're never going to get an alternative financial system out of this. And if you're going to make this about just number go up, then I fear that a lot of people are going to say, you know what, I could put my money with a VC. I could put my money in building. I could, you know, hire some coders. Nah, I'll just go buy IBIT and watch number go up. Or maybe that doesn't happen directly, but it might be harder to attract money. One of the other arguments I think people make is that, oh, these rich guys in these country clubs are going to call their wealth managers from their Porsche, and they're going to say, put 3% of my money in Bitcoin. And then when they see Bitcoin go up, they're going to say, how do I get myself one of those electronic wallets and move into that system and take all of my money out of the current system? No, it's going to go the other way. Mm-hmm. They're going to go, man, this is way easier than buying this stuff on chain. This is way easier than even opening a Coinbase account. I think I'm going to move all my money back into my regulated brokerage account. And I'm just going to punt these ETFs. I think it's going to reduce adoption. It's not going to increase adoption. So what we need is an alternative financial system. We in the United States don't need it. Mm. But like I said, Africa, Asia, the Middle East, Latin America, they could use it. In fact, I heard a great statistic today. The stablecoin Tether, over 50% of people in Brazil have used the stablecoin Tether to buy something in the last year. Over 50% in Brazil. That's because those places in the world, they need this. We don't need this in Greenwich, Connecticut. They need it here, or they need it out there, excuse me. And that's why I think we need to continue to build this system out. And anything that turns this into a trading sardine and gets our eye off the ball of what we're trying to do, I think is very dangerous for the long-term health of it. I'm not ready to say it's bad. I'm still bullish on the system. I just think that we're losing the narrative here. And we're just thinking about this as being red and blue chip casino chips, as opposed to the alternate financial system, which it is ultimately has to become.
Last question on the topic before we move over to macro. What do you think it means for the, you know, centralized sort of the centralized power that Larry Fink and BlackRock ultimately, if you see all these assets flow into these ETFs, what does that ultimately mean for a network that's supposed to be decentralized and the power distributed? What is that? In what ways can that maybe be the opposite of what the whole point was in the beginning?
Yeah, so back on what I was saying before, that it is a decentralized, permissionless asset. No one can control it. No one can put rules on it. No one can tell you what you can or can't do with your money. Anything that comes along and centralizes it, Lynn Walden wrote a great book called Broken Money. I would recommend it. But in the book, she said, throughout history, whenever we've had a problem trying to, you know, modernize the financial system, we've always solved it by centralizing it more. And unfortunately, I see this exactly happen. We had a problem with adoption. We had a problem with reaching more people to get them more involved in crypto. So we centralized it in an ETF, and we centralized it on the New York Stock Exchange. You're giving more centralized power for a decentralized asset. And ultimately, those are in conflict. Now, my Bitcoin maxi friends will say, but they can't do anything. The blockchain runs. They can't touch that. No, they can. But they can exert themselves in other ways. You want an example? I'm not saying this will happen. An example? Larry Fink and BlackRock invented ESG. They could come out and say the hash power right now of the network is too much. And because of environmental concerns, we're going to go to some sort of centralized proof of stakes chain. And we're going to fork into that. And we're going to move all 10 ETFs to the new chain. And I called Jeremy Allaire at Circle. He's going to move the circles to that chain as well, too. And I called Paolo at Tether. He's going to move to that chain, too. Fine. Your chain, your proof of work, Satoshi original chain will continue. It'll become like Bitcoin Cash when they had the blockchain wars in 2017. They spun them off into Bitcoin Cash. It's zero return for the last 7 years. It still exists, doesn't trade that much. And so that's the risk. That's a risk you face. Now, I'm not saying he will do that, fork it into a proof of stake chain because it uses 1% of the power of a proof of work chain under the guise of ESG, but he can. And this is the risk you run when you put together a centralized solution when you should be looking for decentralized solutions.
Kind of a scary thought, actually, now that I think about it. Can I ask you, Jim, if we transition over to macro really quickly, the last time you and I spoke, the narrative was between hard landing and soft landing, which one would manifest itself. And 13, 14 months later, I come back, the narrative is between soft landing and no landing. But even Nouriel Roubini has come around, and he was saying that the no landing scenario is in play here.
Oh, then I'm back in the hard landing camp.
So let me ask you, in your very simple opinion, do you think the data supports that the Fed has done enough here?
Yeah, so I do. What do you mean by done enough? I guess let me define it the way I would define it, and I'll define it a little bit differently. There's an old adage on Wall Street that the Fed raises rates till something breaks. Mm-hmm. And I think over the last 18 months, we've talked about, has the Fed been breaking things because they've got interest rates too high? The stock market fell 25% in 2022. The bond market had an awful year. Was that what broke? Almost a year ago to the day, we had the banks blow up. Was that what was broken? And along the way, we've talked about, is housing been broken because of higher interest rates? And I think the answer to all of those questions right now is no. Nothing has been broken. Housing is struggling, but it's hardly broken at all right now. And so I think that as we look at the economy, the conclusion we could come to is a 5.5% funds rate, it can handle it. And it is handling it. And that's why we're having no landing. And that's why we're kind of, not in my opinion, we're getting sticky at around 3% inflation. And if the economy can handle that, and we're still sticky around 3% inflation, there is no reason for the Fed to cut rates. I'm not going to go all the way and say that they should be raising rates again. Let's just talk about cutting rates right now. I started the year in the 0 to 2% cut rate cuts camp. And right now I'm closer to zero than I am to two. I know Torsten Slok recently came out and he's in the zero camp. And then I saw Rafael Bostic yesterday came out in a speech. He's the Atlanta Fed president. He was very dovish. And he said that they should probably cut and pause. which is a fancy way of saying he's in the one rate cut camp. Mm-hmm. It was 6 weeks ago, or maybe 7 weeks ago now, that the market was actually pricing in seven rate cuts for the year. And now we're down to somewhere between zero and three because the data is consistently strong. And I think that the narrative that everybody's saying is the Fed has to cut, because if they don't, the jobs market's going to fall apart, real estate's going to crash, and all of this other stuff that they're saying. None of that's happening right now. But the Fed's got to cut because commercial real estate is having a problem. New York Community Bank is on the ropes. Well, that's true. They are in the ropes and they are having a problem. But their solution is not lower interest rates. Their solution is more of a regulatory problem and basically a loan loss provision problem. And interest rates are not going to be the solution to that rate. So the simple fact I would give you is rates are not punishing. And that is one of the reasons why I don't think the Fed needs to cut rates. And, you know, tomorrow and the next day, Powell is going to be speaking tomorrow before the House, Thursday before the Senate. Mm-hmm. And this is his semi-annual testimony about the state of the economy. We'll get a better idea of what his thinking is in the next 48 hours. And then we'll get the payroll report on Friday. So in 72 hours, we'll have a lot better feel for where we stand when it comes to monetary policy and the economy than we do right now.
Jim, are you anything like me? When he testifies in front of Congress, you curl up in front of the couch with a big tub of popcorn and you watch the whole thing start to finish, because my family and friends think I'm a complete degenerate with what I'm interested in. Are you something like that?
Yeah, but I'm always
watch the whole thing.
Yes, because I'm waiting for the stupidest question to be asked to the Fed chairman.
The House
usually is the king of the stupid questions. And you know, I also found too, what I found is really kind of interesting is when these congressmen, especially these junior congressmen, start asking the Fed chairman questions and they don't know what they're talking about, it gets really fun. Mm-hmm. But I always said people get all apoplectic, because here's some junior congressman and he obviously doesn't know what to ask the Fed chairman. So he's reading it off an index card. He probably asked some economics professor from his local university to write down some questions. I'm like, actually, that's not a bad thing, because some of those questions are actually pretty good questions. I'm sure the guy doesn't know what he's asking him, but it's a pretty good question that he's asking him. And if more congressmen actually did that, ask somebody, what's a good question to ask them? You know, then it would be better off than a lot of the questions, because what they wind up doing is they wind up going into stuff that the Federal Reserve doesn't have any say in. You know, mm-hmm. What do you think about the defense budget? You know,
they try to bring Powell into cultural stuff,
right,
political
or
things that he's not going to answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or fiscal policy, which he will not answer. And the reason they ask him that, they don't really know what the Federal Reserve does. And so they don't really know. That's what they know, and they don't really know how to ask him questions about banking or monetary policy or any of the things that really he has dominion over.
You, speaking of politics for just a second, we had a conversation yesterday around, you know, the fact that Trump came out and he said if he was reelected that he would not reappoint Jerome Powell, and whether or not that's playing into some decisions. I listened to something that you said. You don't really think that factors in too much. You actually think you think he's being political, but in a completely different way, and it has to do all with that July meeting. I wonder if you could walk us through what you think the political calculations are for Jerome Powell and the Federal Reserve as we approach that July meeting.
So first of all, let's get through. Let's tell you what Trump really said is that he's going to have SEAL Team 6 rappelling down from helicopters to physically remove Powell from the Eccles building as soon as he becomes Federal Reserve chairman. And that's going to be coming about 5 minutes after noon on January 20th, 2025, if he wins. Powell's out. But in all seriousness, I do think the Fed is apolitical. Now, what I mean by apolitical, or somebody said to me, the Fed is political and not partisan. And I like that phrasing better. Partisan. They do not sit around the table and say, what policy gets our preferred candidate elected? Now, we assume it's Biden because of what Trump said, but let's just leave it generically. They don't do that. They don't sit around and go, what would help one candidate versus the other? So they're not partisan. But I do think that they are political. What the Fed historically likes to do in an election year is be invisible. They don't want their name coming up. They don't want to be mentioned. They don't want to be considered part of the narrative of who gets elected. You know, it's Homer Simpson, you know, kind of fading into the bushes. That's what the Fed wants to do. So what we're talking about now is a cut, is a change of policy. The current policies hold. The Fed has never cut, or excuse me, I mean, the Fed has never started a new policy in the summer, between the summer and Election Day, started a new policy. They will continue a policy if they were cutting or raising. They would continue to do that in the summer up to Election Day. If there's a crisis like we had in 2020, all bets are off. Then they're just dealing with the crisis. And it doesn't matter that it's an election year. Or 2008 was another one, too. So I've said that it's kind of May, June or bust, that if they're going to cut rates, it's either going to come in May or June. The July 31st meeting is a week after the Republican convention and a couple of weeks before the Democrat convention. And remember, Victor and I are both in Chicago. The Republican convention, the Democrat convention is in Chicago, and the Republican convention is in Milwaukee. So we're right in the, thick of convention row right here. And so I don't think the Fed wants to start a new policy the week after the Republicans are in Milwaukee, 2 weeks before the Democrats are in Chicago. That will look partisan, and that will get them into the debate, into the narrative. So I said May, June, or after the election. After the election, there is a meeting November 7th, 2 days after the, you know, or 2 days after the election, and then there's another meeting in December. So it's either May, June, or the end of the year is where I think that the July and the September meetings will only fit a continuation of the policy. If they cut in May or June, then the policy's cut. They might be able to continue it into July or September. If they hold in May or June, then the continuation is you hold in July or September. Now, the problem that the Fed is facing, if you look at market probabilities from the Fed Fund futures, March is out, it's like got a 2% chance the Fed is going to cut rates. May's got like a 20% chance they're going to cut rates. That's out. And then you get to June, and it's around a 60% chance that they're going to cut rates. It's above 50, but it's still only 60. It's very it's very open whether or not they're going to wind up. It might even come down to, you know, the print on Friday with payrolls and next week with CPI to really seal the fate on the June meeting. If, you know, if the numbers are strong, then that meeting's done. If they're weak, maybe we open the door for that meeting. So I think it's got to come sooner rather than later, because I just don't see the Fed wanting to see two presidential candidates arguing about the Fed in the middle of an election year. That's exactly what they don't want.
And to your point, the March 8th payrolls, I think it's the 8th, March 8th payrolls and the 12th, the CPI on the 12th, from your standpoint, that could be a huge catalyst for moving the market either off or on that June date.
Well, let me give you two stats. The March probabilities of a cut in March were above 50% as priced by the Fed Fund futures until the day of the January payroll on February 2nd was the January payroll report. It came in at 353,000 jobs, way hotter than expected. Those March probabilities fell below 50% 2 minutes after that report came, and they've never been above it. Basically, the January payroll report on February 2nd killed off the March meeting. Then the following week, I think it was the 14th of February, we got the January CPI. It was hotter than expected. The May meeting, 2 minutes after that report came out, fell below 50% probability that the Fed was going to cut rates, and hasn't been above that number either. So the last two payroll reports respectively killed off the March and the May meeting. Now the June meeting's on tap, and we'll see what we get. Now, I'm not implying that we're going to get another strong number. Maybe we get a weak number on Friday. You know, and that opens the door back up for May, or, you know, that could very well be the case. But my larger point is it's all going to be dictated by that number. And then it's going to be followed up by that next big number on CPI. I wish it wasn't this way, but, you know, this is kind of the way it is right now. The Fed is focused on inflation and the market's worried that they've raised rates too much and they're going to break something. So the market's focused on payrolls as a signal that they've broken something and they haven't gotten it yet. And the Fed's focused on inflation as a reason or the data point to give them to cut rates. And they haven't gotten that yet. So we'll see what the next set of data gives us.
How much credence do you put in? Even Larry Summers himself only put 15% probability on his meaningful chance of a hike before the end of the year. How much credence do you put that? Does 15% sound about right to you? And do you, is this kind of like this outside outlier move potential, but that's not your focus?
Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, I'm, like I said, I'm closer to zero rate cuts this year. I put a 15%. 15, just to be clear on everybody, it's less than 50%. So it's not like we're expecting a rate cut or he's expecting a rate cut. But I do think that there is an outlier chance. Of what I'm arguing here to you is the economy can handle these rates. We are in no landing. No landing just means that the plane doesn't come down. It just keeps flying. We just keep cranking out 2.5%, 3% quarters. We keep cranking out decent economic numbers. And we keep getting sticky inflation. You might be able to open the door to a rate hike later this year. But right now, the focus is on cuts. Like I said, 6 weeks ago, we were, you know, we being the market pricing 7 cuts. Now we're at 3-ish, maybe 2.5 or 3-ish. And in the next 72 hours, those probabilities are kind of probably move one way or the other, depending on what Powell says in the payroll report. And then followed up next week with the CPI. We could be in a far different place right now. We could be down to 1 cut, or we could be back to 5, depending on what Powell says and what the data says. But it's going to be the next week or so that's going to really move things.
What does that mean for, you know, you're talking about no cuts to up to 2. You're talking about a continuously strong economy. What does that mean then for the 10-year? You know, where would you sort of, where's your probability of distribution as you look into the end of the year about what number feels about right in terms of the 10-year yield?
Oh, the number that's chiseled on my headstone, according to Twitter, it's 5.5%, because I said that I think the 10-year is going to 5.5%, and my career is over if we don't get it at that point. But don't worry, it's been over before, and it'll be over again, you know, in the future many times. I'm just kidding. But here's how I arrive at that number. First of all, no rate cut. We're already at the funds rate of 5.25 to 5.25 funds rate. No rate cut. If we wind up getting 2.5% real growth, and that is what we've averaged over the last 6 quarters, is 2.5%. So continuation of what we've seen, real growth. If we continue to get what I believe we're going to get is somewhere around 3% inflation, you add the two together, and that's nominal GDP. Of 5.5%. Nominal GDP should
those
be
are,
a
those
good
are China numbers.
Right. Well, that's nominal. Remember now, this is also right. Including inflation. Sure. China wants 5% real, and then some inflation on top of that. But if you get 5.5% nominal, and by the way, we had over 6 last year. So I'm even talking about it kind of slowing a little bit from last year. Then where should interest rates be? 5.5. Where is the funds rate? 5.5. What is the what happens if the 10-year goes to 5.5 sometime this year? The yield curve just goes to 0. And that's all I'm saying is that I think that the funds rate's going to stay up there. The economy is going to stay strong. And the yield curve is eventually going to just, you know, uninvert by 1 basis point, if you will, or go back to flat, dead flat. Well, that's the 10-year going to 5.5 is where it is. Now, people look at that and go, holy shit, 5.5, it's going to crush the world. And I was like, you know, we were at 5 in October. We weren't that far away from it in October. But the only reason that you think that is because we're also anchored to that 2010 to 2020 period when we were looking at 1 and 2% interest rates and 0 on the front end of the yield curve. And we kind of got used to it and we kind of convinced ourselves that was normal. No, that was the abnormal. These rates we're looking at now, and even that 5.5, might be closer to what we would consider normal. It's just we had this big string of abnormally low rates with quantitative easing that, you know, has got us anchored on the wrong space, thinking that 2 is normal, where I'm thinking 5.5 is normal.
There seems to be some asymmetry to your opinion, because almost nobody is thinking, or at least positioning, I should say, for 5.5% 10-year.
Yeah, not quite nobody, but you're right. It's a small crowd.
Right.
I can get a handful of tickets and take them all to a game, you know, once they want to be in there. But here's why. I'll tell you why. Wall Street forecasts what it wants. Wall Street does not forecast what it thinks will happen. Wall Street wants lower interest rates. Now, sometimes Wall Street gets what it wants. So every time Wall Street forecasts something, it's not always wrong. It's just most of the time wrong is what it winds up being. Why does Wall Street want lower interest rates? Dr. Jeremy Siegel wrote the book Stocks for the Long Run. Mm-hmm. And I'll summarize it real quick. What is the probability of what should you expect the stock market to do over the next several years? About 8% a year. Yeah, not 8% every year, but average 8%. Okay, if it's 2019, and I'll keep it simple and use money markets, and the money market funds are at zero, you could scream Tina as loud as you want. There is no alternative. What are you sitting there in a zero money market fund? You've got to move into stocks. Mm-hmm. Okay, but it's 2024 and money funds are 5.3%. That's 65, 70% of what the stock market's supposed to give you. And your money market fund's going to give you a $1 NAV every day. There are a lot of boomers that will say, you know, sign me up. I'll take 70% of the stock market and no risk whatsoever. Done. Done deal. I'll take that all day long. So what does Wall Street want? It wants lower rates. Why? So they could scream at them, Tina, you got to move into stocks. Come on, let's go. That's why I think that since the stock bond yields peaked in November, you've had 16 in the last 18 weeks, stocks have been up. Mm-hmm. But weren't we at 7 rate cuts and now we're at 3 and we're talking about zero? We're talking about that. The stock market, my equity friends are like, you guys are stuck in a week. The Fed's going to cut rates. They said they're going to cut rates. Well, the Fed says a lot of things that don't come to pass. You know, if you've been following them closely for the last couple of years, whatever happened to that transitory inflation thing is one example. But, you know, so they're convinced there's going to be rate cuts. There's going to be an ability to scream Tina in somebody's face and tell them to get into the stock market. Whether it's March, May, June, July, you know, that's for you bond guys to get all obsessed about. All we in the stock market care about is we're going to get our rate cuts and we're going to get the competition of higher yields away. We're going to push those down. Mm. I still think there's going to be, if my forecast is correct, I've had plenty of wrong ones, but if it's correct, there's going to be a moment where the stock market's going to go, holy shit, we're not going to get this rate cut that we thought we were going to get. And that wall of money that's, you know, that cash is
the cash on cash the sidelines.
Yeah, you know, for whatever it's worth, I started on Wall Street in 1986. And the first week I was there, the strategist that I was employed, I was his assistant, told me about cash on the sidelines. And here we are in March of 2024, and we're still fucking talking about cash on the sidelines. It will always be there. You know, cash on the sidelines will always be this potential that will never, ever be realized. But yes, we're starting to talk about cash on the sidelines. But the assumption about cash on the sidelines is that rates go down so we could, you know, push people to get out and get into more riskier assets. But we'll see. We'll see what the Fed says as far as where they're going to go. We'll find out as early as tomorrow morning when Chairman Powell starts testifying.
So then what do you do about that 3%, Jim? 3% is not the Fed's target, Jim.
Right, right. I think what people need to understand is, let me talk about 3% is not two. That is not the Fed's target. I'll assume there's a fair number of people listening to this going, oh, God, you bond guys, 3, 2, 2, 3. You know, you guys are arguing about a rounding error. It's, you know, it's not Zimbabwe. Okay, I get it. It's not Zimbabwe, but it does matter because it matters for interest rates. And here's where it really matters. The BLS and the Fed do studies of consumer finances. And let me summarize it real fast. The top 50% in income, and you need like $60,000, I think, to be in the top 50 or above to be in the top 50% of income. They own 95% of the assets in the United States. That is half the people own almost all of the stocks, bonds, and real estate in the United States. The top 10% own 50% of the assets in the United States. And they have very little debt. The bottom 50%, they don't own any assets, but they have over half the debt in the United States. Credit card debt, some mortgage debt, personal loans, car loans, et cetera. They have all the debt. So when inflation is at 3% or 3.5%, bottom 50% is crushed because they get in a 3 or 4% wage, you know, raise at their job. But if prices are going up 3 or 4%, that just keeps them at even. And then those higher interest rates wind up costing them to pay out a higher interest expense. they get crushed. The top 50% doesn't have the debt burden, but they see stocks at a new high. They see home prices holding up. And if they have money market funds or bond funds, they're throwing off a yield. Or as my friend Jim Grant likes to say, he writes the newsletter Grant's Interest Rate Observer. Mm-hmm. It's nice to have an interest rate to observe again, is what we've got in the bond market right now. And so they're all happy. That's why you can have two things be true at the same time. The economy is doing well. Why? Because the top half is also about 80% of consumer spending. And the top 10% is something like 40 to 50% of consumer spending. So they're spending and they're keeping the no landing going. But it's one person, one vote. So when you ask Jeff Bezos who he's going to vote for president, that counts for one. Mm-hmm. And if you ask somebody who's being crushed by inflation in the bottom 50%, that counts as one. That's why the president's approval rating is down in the tank, is because the bottom half is not participating. They did in 2019. Yeah, the stock market was roaring and home prices were roaring and the rich were making it. But the bottom half was seeing that they were getting a 3% raise and they had 1% inflation. So they were getting better. And they were seeing that borrowing costs were lower. Now, if Powell was to cut rates to try and give them relief, it could backfire. If he cuts rates and the stock market goes ballistic and everybody starts spending money like drunken sailors and inflation reignites, he makes the bottom half worse off. So he's got to be very, very careful with cutting rates, is because if it kicks off a spending boom that kicks off demand for stuff that kicks off inflation, you make it worse. And one last thought for you on this. Coming out of every recession or financial crisis, the economy changes. Mm. Now, change does not mean worse. I'm not saying it gets worse. It just changes. Coming out of the financial crisis in 08, people were very worried about their savings. So we saw 6% savings rates, which means you spend 94% of your paycheck and you save 6%. And when the stock market in 2010, 11, 12, 13 started going up and your home price started to recover, you didn't spend it. You felt good that your savings, your net worth was increasing. Your rainy day fund was getting larger. So you just looked at your brokerage statement, keep it simple. You looked at your brokerage statement, you were just happy it was getting larger. But in 2020, when we had the shutdown restart, that attitude changed. Coming out of that, we saw the early instances of it. Meme stock, speculation, Reddit on options. Remember, anybody remember Roaring Kitty and all of that crazy ass stuff we did? And now we're starting to see that the savings rate, it's not 6%, it's 4%. We're spending more money. So, and we've termed it doom travel, doom spending, revenge travel. You know, we've got terms for this spending. We want to spend. Maybe it's PTSD. You know, man, I'm not going through that again. I'm going to live my life. I'm going to enjoy my life. Maybe it's a cynical attitude. Well, you know, when the shit hit the fan in 2020, I'd walk to the mailbox and there was checks in the mail from the government. So the next time the shit hits the fan, they're going to mail me more money. Now, you might not be wrong on that. So for right now, I'm going to buy a new car and I'm going to take that trip to Italy because I've always wanted to do that. I'm just not going to be satisfied that my brokerage statement is larger this month than it was last month. And so there's a prominent Wall Street strategist, David Kelly at JP Morgan, who gave a presentation a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about how they're spending like crazy. And he said, what are they going to do when they're 62? And my answer to him, I muttered under my breath, he didn't hear me, they'll figure it out when they're 61 is what they're going to do. But until 61, damn it, they're going to enjoy their life the best that they possibly can. So that will be, so if the Fed cuts rates in this kind of spending kind of mentality, you could kick off inflation. And even though you might cut rates and say, let's give the bottom half some relief, you can make it worse for them if it winds up creating animal spirits. And those animal spirits go straight to Amazon or what's left of the shopping malls in America in order to push prices higher. That's what you've got to be careful about.
With the last few minutes, you mentioned Tina earlier. I wonder if we could just really quickly talk about what's happening outside of the United States. You've got deflation in China, Germany's economy looking a bit shaky, UK, Japan in a technical recession, although enjoying all-time highs. I don't know. That deserves a bit of context.
Yes. They're up 1% in 35 years. So take that P&L and spend it wisely.
So how do you think about U.S. markets relative to global markets, and specifically, how does that relate to currencies, interest rate differentials, and most importantly, currencies?
Right. So let me start with the last thing I talked about, that coming out of the pandemic, we spend a lot more money. And because we spend a lot more money, we're getting a lot more GDP, and we've got big budget deficits too. And the government is spending a lot more money. And that almost single-handedly right there explains why we're no landing. It's because we just spend, and the government just spends through budget deficits as well. Europe, and by the way, coming out of the pandemic, you could tell that there's been a cultural change. It's referred to as remote work. You know, everybody's in the office 3 days a week, not 5 days a week. That's not happening in the rest of the world. What's happening in the rest of the world is their spending patterns and their remote work patterns are reverting back to something where near 2019. So when all the economists are talking about a hard landing, which is a recession or a soft landing, and predicting it in the United States, I like to say what they've done is they've assumed that we're still running the 2019 model. And it says we should be sinking towards recession or at least a soft landing. But because of the budget deficit change and the spending change, that's not in their model. But the rest of the world didn't change. So their models are actually pretty accurate. You're right. The UK's had two consecutive negative quarters, technical recession. So is Japan. Germany has had a negative quarter. The whole Eurozone has had a negative quarter. And Canada has had a negative quarter. These are GDP either in Q3 or Q4. At least one or both of those quarters were negative. But the US had a monstrous 4.9 in the third quarter and 3.3 in the fourth quarter, while everybody else was printing negative numbers. That's because they're closer to 2019. We're at a different place because of the pandemic. And so that, I think, was what, like, when I hear my Anna Wong of Bloomberg Economics, very good economist, but she's been predicting a recession, and she's got this model that says we have a recession. I say, your model's dead on for the UK, Japan, Canada, and Germany, because they didn't change. But the US changed, and that's why it's not working here. And so, and that's the way that, you know, I've argued that. So what does that mean? We're going to stay stronger than they are. Interest rates are going to stay higher than they are. Our inflation is going to stay stickier than theirs is. And if we're going to have a interest rate differential, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Bank of England and the ECB cut rates and we don't, and widen that differential, then the dollar will stay stronger. Now, it won't be boomingly strong. It's up 1% or 2% so far this year. It's stronger now than it was in December. But I think we're going to continue to see a somewhat stronger dollar than we have been seeing over the last several years. And because we're the strong economy with the higher interest rate, it's just that simple. That means that investing in international securities, if you're an American investor, means that you're going to have to fight a headwind that you're buying something in a weaker currency. Now, if you're a foreign investor investing in the United States, you're buying something into a stronger currency as well. And finally, as far as the new highs, yes, there's new highs in Germany. There's new highs in Japan in their markets, even though, you know, they're printing negative GDPs. But let's not forget now that those markets have so chronically underperformed. Like I said, the Nikkei in Japan is at the same level it was in 1989. I mean, Microsoft is bigger than some of these countries' stock markets at this point. So it's not like it takes a tremendous amount of money to push these markets back to new highs. But they're there. But I don't necessarily think that it's going to lead to some massive wealth effect and some massive change. They're not spending. Their markets aren't that big. Their attitudes about their markets, I'm talking about Japan, UK, Germany, that their attitudes about their markets are, they're kind of things for the wealthy, but it's not like my piggy bank. We here think the stock markets are piggy bank. You know, I put money into zero DTE options and then I go buy a Lambo. That's the way it's supposed to work. Never does work that way, but it's supposed to work that way. They don't even think of it in those terms. We do.
Jim, I could go on and on. We could do another 90 minutes, but I'm going to be respectful of your time, my friend.
Jim, all right. Well, then you got to answer a question for me.
Okay.
All right. So Bears starting quarterback, game one, Justin Fields or Caleb Williams?
Can I say Fields? Are you going to get?
Yes.
Can I say Fields?
I actually think it should be Fields, and they should trade for a bunch of first round picks and get, as I mentioned to you right before we started, they need dudes. They need some real players on that team. So let's get some real players and see what Fields can do with real players.
Jim,
but I think it's going to be Caleb Williams. But
you do?
Yes, I would like it to be Fields, but I think it's going to be Caleb Williams.
You're a good man. Jim Bianco, before you get out of here, I wonder if you would do us all a favor. If the people want more from you, and I'm sure they do, could you let us know where we can find more of your work, of your sort of your posts on a day-to-day basis? And I know you've got a new entity you're running as well.
Yes. You can find me at biancoresearch.com. It's my research site. Research site means there's another site coming. You can find me at Bianco Research on YouTube. You could find me at Bianco Research on Twitter, and Jim Bianco on LinkedIn. The new entity is, there is an ETF. I do have a long-only fixed income ETF. Its website is Bianco Advisors, as opposed to Bianco Research. And its ticker symbol is WTBN, the Wisdom Tree Bianco Fund. WT, Whiskey, Tango, Bravo, Nancy is what the ticker is. You want to check it out. If you got any questions, you could DM me. We don't have an OnlyFans account yet, but, you know, we'll have to see whether or not Wall Street's ready to go there just yet. I don't know. What about you guys? Does Tasty Trade have an OnlyFans social yet?
If they
God,
do,
I hope I, not. I know, God, I hope not.
I know nothing of it, and I don't want to know. Jim,
TMI? Is that really going into TMI then with that?
There's probably a market for it, but no thank you, my friend. Jim, you're a gentleman and scholar from the bottom of my heart. Thanks for coming on the launch week. Wish you the best of luck with the new entity, with the ETF and everything else you got going on. We hope to talk to you soon. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
For everybody out there as well, we'll see you tomorrow with Michael Guyad, same time, same place, only on Tasty Life. Peace, everybody.